From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
So you think you're familiar with marigolds and zinnias, huh? Well, it's time to take another look, I think, as I have been longingly in the seed list from Oregon-based Peace Seedlings. Among their offerings are multi-toned zinnias in shades you won't have seen before, with names like Dayglow Mix and Rainbow Eyes. And there's a selection of not just any little old marigold, like the ones in the Garden Center cell packs, but instead extravagant 3 and 4 and even 6 foot high plants loaded with flowers for cutting, or shrubby ones like Red Metamorph that could form a beautiful garden hedge if planted in a row, or even a 10-footer that's also known as Mexican tarragon, whose leaves are harvested as a culinary herb. So who knew? They're all the work of the Peace Seedlings team, who are here today to talk about their anything but ordinary varieties. So more in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
Delana Capular and her partner, Mario Di Benedetto, founded Peace Seedlings in 2009 after helping her parents, Alan and Linda Capular, with their longtime seed breeding project called Peace Seeds. They've been building on the legacy of Alan's decades of organic seed breeding, and I'm so glad they're here today from Corvallis, Oregon, to talk about some of that continuing work. Hello to you, too. How are you?
Great.
Doing great. Thank you. Hi.
It's so good to reconnect. I always love looking at your list every year. And
Thank you.
So I think the first Capular bread thing I got addicted to was so many years ago, I hate to admit. It was something of your father, Delana. It was called Three Root Grex Beet, which you still sell. And each packet yielded beets of three possible colors, I think pinkish red and orange and gold. And he was one of the great and most innovative seed breeders of the modern era, I think, especially among the organic seed breeders. And I know you lost him, and we all lost him in the end of 2023. But the work lives on. Yes, you too continue.
Yes, well, he would be thrilled to hear you, unbelievably thrilled to hear you say that.
Oh.
You speak so sweetly of him. And yeah, the Three Root Grex Beets is kind of the rainbow of beets, kind of like the rainbow chard of beets, but an interbreeding population creates so many different types of beets, more than just the three colors, but all the different shades mixed together. And we've kind of, it's inspired us to do that with a lot of different crops and see what the interbreeding of different things can lead you to ultimately.
Yeah, so he had interest in a lot of different crops, and a couple of the things I mentioned in the introduction were marigolds and zinnias. And first, we should probably say it's not too late to sow either one, no matter really where you are, because, I mean, I think you guys probably don't use sow successions of some of these for at your farm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We keep planting until about June, especially with the marigolds, to have them, you know, for late flowering for Dia de los Muertos and, you know, generally fall flowers. They're best when sown late.
Yeah. So you're like, and again, as I also said in the introduction, like your marigolds, for example, don't really look like the marigolds in the cell packs, like Little Gem or Tangerine Gem, you know, the Signet types or whatever, those little guys, which are adorable, you know, but this is a different beast. So tell me a little bit about, like, how did you end up with all these big marigolds, and what's the direction and what goes into making a marigold?
Well, my dad had been extremely fond of marigolds from all of his gardening, but then got his hands on a few different marigolds in, I'm sure it was probably, I don't know, hard to know exactly, but I know early 90s, he got really into marigold breeding, and he got his hands on the classic marigold, which is called pinwheel, and he found like old drawings from old seed catalogs that showed that it was from maybe even like mid 1800s or early 1800s. And he was just fascinated by how there was these, and pinwheel isn't like a really tall marigold, but it's immediate. It's not like a tiny bedding plant.
Right.
And so he found that and then got his hand on another medium sized marigold and started doing some crossing. And then it led him down the road of like finding all these in betweens and then doubles and singles. And he had some different varieties that when we started gardening with him, we were like impressed by them and the size of the plant, the stature, the stiffness of the stem. And in our work doing some bouquets for market and different stuff like that, we realized, oh, this is like a whole, and having more double flowers at market, doubles just last a lot longer than single flowers in a bouquet or on a plant. So we started selecting for those a lot.
So some of them have years of background. It sounds like it takes a long time. I mean, it doesn't just happen overnight. And these are all, we should probably say, I mean, besides that you farm organically, these are also, I believe your father used to say, he called it open source. Is that what he used to say? Open source seeds?
He actually started with public domain.
Okay.
Yeah, that was his take on it, which, I mean, at the time, yeah, I mean, the only other similar thing was sort of open source software, but for whatever reason, he liked the terminology public domain.
Right. So these were not patented, you know, where, you know, it was like a trademark, so to speak. None of this kind of thing.
No. And I think, yeah, I remember him talking about how with the original pinwheel, that there was a story where someone actually had tried to patent that. And that's where they realized it was such an old marigold. Someone pulled out an old painting that depicted pinwheel exactly. And it was maybe what was the defining factor for this case of someone trying to patent it. It was proved that it was already there. And a lot of people wonder, you know, what is public domain? And it's as simple as that's what heirloom seeds are. A lot of people know what an heirloom variety is, something that's passed down for generations. And, you know, anyone can grow that. It's all really public domain is. It's nothing fancy, but it's putting it out there in a context of this isn't patented and you can't patent it because it's been put into the public domain.
Right. So tell me about a couple of examples. I mean, I mentioned one that I mentioned in the introduction is the one that's grown as an herb, really. Wakutai, I think you pronounce it. It's like Wakutai. It gets to 10 feet tall, I think.
Yeah. Tagetes minuta. It's pretty hilarious that the species is minuta.
Minuta little.
Yeah. It's because it does have a very tiny flower. And, you know, there's common names can be confusing. It is sometimes called a Mexican marigold or black marigold, although I thought the Mexican tarragon was actually Tagetes
lucida,
which is actually a shorter plant, also a small flower, but common names can be thrown around. So that might also be the case, but in case someone's looking and gets confused, that might be also.
Those two are some of the marigolds we've done less of our own hands-on breeding, but we offer them because they're both used traditionally as herbs where they come from. And the Tagetes minuta, which you first mentioned, the Wakutai, is a Peruvian herb that is used to make this Wakutai sauce that is this amazing South American, or in Peru a lot mostly, I'm sure a lot of different parts of South America, but the sauce that they make with the ahi pepper and lime and the marigold leaves, and it creates this really amazing, and sometimes they add cream or cheese, and it's this really delicious like cream sauce that is nothing really like it in our cuisine other than like, I mean, I guess people are, I mean, it's its own thing. It's delicious. And the marigolds have a lot of different medicinal properties for health and immune system strength.
Alan Capulier, Delana's dad, goes by Mushroom, so in case people are confused there. he had originally started growing it because it had been also touted as a nematodal insecticides. So people would grow that to keep some of the different nematode pest issues at bay, which it also has lore for. People would plant it around their houses to keep ticks and, you know, all sorts of things like that, that it, you know, allegedly was effective at
discouraging.
So,
yeah. Yeah. So tell me each one of you, tell me one that you, among the sort of more ones grown for more ornamental purposes or for cutting, or tell me one example that you each particularly like. I don't know who
wants
to go first.
Well, I'm pretty excited about the Sunbright mix. We just started offering that this last year, and it's about 3-foot shrub, and it's a mixture of like oranges and yellows and all doubles. We've pretty much selected most of the lines that we started offering in the last handful of years are all doubles. We also really love to make marigold lays. So having the double flowers just makes for really full, beautiful lays that dry great, but are also stay fresh for days and are just, it's fun to surround yourself in that fragrance and beauty. And these shrubs, as I say, are like oranges and yellows. It's a pretty beautiful mix and creates a great, as you're saying, garden border. And makes for great stems for cutting.
Okay, so that's the Sunbright mix. Okay, what about you?
Yeah, it's always hard to find a favorite. I mean, I love I love them all, really. I mean, the Burgundy Bliss is probably the first, I think it was the first line that we offered. We had, you know, been able to pull out this double Burgundy marigold, and they get to be sort of 5 feet tall. I mean, they're, you know, borderline getting crazy tall in terms of, you know, having them in your garden in the fall. You have to, you know where to put them. A strong storm can whack them down. But at the same time, they make so many amazing flowers, and they are just impressive. A lot of people really love to blow their neighbors away. That's what I get a lot from people who grow them, just because nobody's seen a marigold that tall. And I mean, the Tagetes erecta, which is like La Ribera and commonly in the garden magazines, they call them African marigold, which
yes.
is sort of deceiving since they are technically South American. But, you know, those are more commonly, they've been taller for a while. They're, you know, down in Mexico for Day of the Dead, they're traditional. They pick those flowers and they're 4 or 5 feet tall. So those are more traditionally tall, but there wasn't a Tagetes patula until Alan started doing some of his hybridizing. They got that tall. So the Burgundy Bliss, having that super tall Burgundy flower, was pretty original and one of a kind. There was, you know, the Tagetes erecta mostly come in just yellows and oranges.
Right.
And you can't get that Burgundy color. And ironically, the erecta and patula do occasionally cross, but they make a sterile triploid. So we've gotten, you know, these unique marigolds where you're like, wow, that's a hybrid. But, you know, time and time after again, they never make seeds again. So I think that was sort of a breakthrough. Getting that super tall, rich Burgundy flower was definitely an original, one-of-a-kind thing.
That's great. So let's just shift to zinnias, which are, you know, again, another really, like, everybody knows them. Everybody's grown them, you know, every beginning gardener even, you know, because they're cooperative and colorful and long blooming and so forth. The ones that I've seen pictures of on your website and, you know, that I've looked at, the colors and the colors, it's like these concentric circles as I look at the flower, you know, down at the flower. It's like these, I don't even know what you call it, the rings of a bullseye or something, but these just beautiful different colors within a single flower. And I mean, how did that even happen? Like, where does that all come from?
yeah, good question.
Well, we got a notion early on that maybe the Zinnia Hagiana would interhybridize with Zinnia elegans. And so we planted an epic, pretty massive spiral of the two species inter spiraling, and we were like, well, if we really could get the best way to get this to work is maybe if we spiral them together, the bees will just get so lost in the spiral, they'll just end up working from one species to the other. Because I don't know, maybe not a lot of people have realized, but a lot of bees, when they start going for a flower, they'll like really work one species for a while and get focused on it. And we don't always like watch the bees enough to notice that, but certain of the native pollinators are especially programmed to do it. They've been doing it for centuries. A lot of, I know, at least over here on the Pacific Northwest in the Willamette Valley here, you talk to bee people and they're like, oh yeah, there used to be a species of bees for pretty much almost every native flower. And they would really hyper-pollinate the species that they were evolved to pollinate.
Wow.
So we don't have honeybees at our garden. Of course, honeybees come and visit, but we have a lot of bumblebees and a lot of other types of small native pollinators. So the spiral was our first like welcoming of that concept. And then following all the things that we saw thereafter really led us to a bunch of these multi-tone zinnias.
Which it was mostly one plant after growing that and then just saving the seed, just, you know, completing cycles. That's what a lot of times it is. And then paying attention. And I remember it was one flower that we could tell looked unique. It had a slightly, it wasn't fully two-tone, but it had a little bit of a two-tone coloration, but it was in an elegans. So that, following that, and then just year after year, growing lots of seed, you know, finding our favorites and doing it again and again and again.
Right.
Led to that.
I love the idea of planting in this spiral, and I just wonder what the bees think. And I use that, I know it's an anthropomorphizing sort of thing, you know, but I just wonder what they think when they like approach such a place of so much, you know, so floriferous and, you know, arranged like that. It must just be like, whoa, look at that. That looks delicious. So among the zinnias, are there some that I also like some of the names, like was one called Yellfire, and there's Dayglow, and, you know, Bundle of Joy. You know, they're very emphatic, effusive names. I love that.
Alan was really good at naming things, and he always worked on like multi-layered meanings. And so like with Yellfire, that was one of our early ones. And when we're originally, you know, collecting the seeds and just following lines, a lot of times it's just describing things. So there was Yellow Fire Fade. And then eventually after writing that 10 times, you start shortening it and there was Yellfire. And then, you know, at the time, Michael Franti put out a really powerful album called Yellfire. And we're like, this is a good name. We're going to keep this. And that was something Washam also liked to do. He liked to pay homage to the music that was inspiring and that, you know, also was politically or, you know, spiritually powerful. And so that, for that one, that's how that one worked out.
Delana, I always wondered if your name came from a musical.
Definitely.
From a certain gentleman about whom a film has been made recently, perhaps.
Yes, I was definitely named after Bob Dylan in essence, for sure.
I was a big fan too. I am a big fan too. With the zinnias there, the colors just blew me away. And I saw, I think it was it last year, I think some at some point I saw that the great flower farmer Florette, Erin of Florette, she like just went wild over your colorways and your zinnias. And she's been doing a lot of zinnia breeding, and she's very influential in the fresh flower, you know, the cut flower farm.
Yeah, we noticed for sure. It was funny because at first she actually did a post talking about her peas, and it was sort of midsummer, and we're like, weird, we're getting orders for peas in like July. This is weird. Maybe it was June, I don't know.
It's different.
Yeah, so then, you know, looked it up, and sure enough, she was doing it. And so in the beginning, she didn't really, you know, say anything. She was a customer, obviously. She was ordering the seeds, and so it was sort of fun. I mean, we're so checked out from that world. We just, you know, nothing against it, but we haven't had the time. It's not in our bandwidth right now to pay attention to all the social media of what's happening. I mean, So yeah, it was fun to you know, see what she was saying. And in a lot of ways, instead of, I feel like, talking about what you're doing and really trying to promote what you're doing, when someone else does it for you, it has even more power. And so,
it does. It's a more authentic feeling, I think, than,
we'd rather be gardening. And so it's nice when other people are like, oh, whoa, this is cool. You're like, oh, good, it is cool. I mean, I thought it was cool, but of course I'm in the middle of it. You know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And you guys, you're definitely, I mean, you know, your catalog, so to speak, is a list. It doesn't have pictures and stuff. It's a list of your varieties, and your website is likewise a list. And to send in my order, I put the money in my list of what I want in an envelope, and I mail it to you. So you don't spend a lot of time doom scrolling and getting engaged with the screen and all that. You are out in the field. You're doing the breeding. You're engaged with the plants and with your children and so forth. And that's your life choice. And that, so it's older school in a way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we pack all the seeds by hand. We do all the packing, the cleaning, the selecting, the breeding, and the whole bit. And that's where we've decided to keep our time. But if anyone ever wants a paper catalog, we do print paper lists, and we send them to the people that order the year before. We don't have like an ongoing mail order list in terms of the people that have ordered in the past, but we do send a list to everybody who has ordered the previous year.
So Mario mentioned peas, and I think just then, and that's another thing that I knew early on, about the pea seeds and then / pea seedlings work, was peas of different colors and with just exceptional flavors. I mean, I'm talking about edible potted peas in particular. And the first one I knew was sugar magnolia, kind of a popular one that people may now have seen elsewhere besides from you, that's made its way into popularity. Yeah. So peas is another thing. And that's one that, even though it may be too late right now to order a packet for spring growing in many places, fall peas, I think, are the best. And tell me, we have, you know, maybe 4 or 5 minutes left, and just tell me a little bit about the range of color there, because again, it's another color story going on.
Well, we've definitely, my dad, was a huge fan of Mendel and got very inspired by Mendel's work, and definitely wanted to, uncork the mystery behind making edible purple peas. And like you said, that's where sugar magnolia came in. And then we used a bunch of the different varieties that he bred to continue down to fulfill that rainbow of peas that we had all been like seeking out to figure out. And he made one yellow pea and the purple pea, and we used those to make a bunch of the ruby peas. So we have Ruby Beauty and Ruby Crescent and a few other different yellow peas, which we call opal, because opal is more of a better descriptivar for what they are. Mm-hmm. And we've been really into hyper tendril peas. So these tendrils that have like a lot more curls than just one curl at the end to hold them up on a trellis. And that has made them a lot easier to grow as a garden plant, regardless of having wind or not. Most all of them are vines, and so they take a little bit of a trellis, but they definitely outperform in yield and quantity than any bush pea you could grow.
Those extra tendrils, it's hilarious. It's like it's unexpected, you know, if you haven't ever tried one, and then you get one with the hyper tendril, you know, trait. And it's like it really holds itself up on the support.
Yeah, they are pretty amazing. And we are working on the whole bush line as well, and continuing getting some more colors. We're on the mission to get a true red pea. The ruby was as red as that we had gotten, but we've just the other year gotten to what we think is more of a real red, is what I was calling it. So there's still more colors to unlock. And that's the whole thing that, you know, we learned under. You never know what you're going to hybridize, like how we got the hypertendril pea in the first place was there was this bush pea called a parsley pea, and instead of a tendril, it had leaflets instead of tendrils.
It was a great salad plant, and the hypertendrils also are delicious in salad when they're super young.
But yeah, who'd have known that crossing that parsley pea with a normal pea would make hypertendril?
Right, right, right.
And there was no commercial variety out there that had that. So it's sort of an basically unknown trait, but has, yeah, a lot of, you know, potential benefits. So that's what we've really, pretty much almost every one of our new lines, except for maybe Opal Beauty, has that hypertendril trait. And then, yeah, trying to get as many diverse colors that, you know, hopefully also then, you know, correlate to different nutrition, because that's a lot of what's interesting about diversity of color and all that is it's different nutrition, and that's sort of the staff of life is that diversity.
And sweetness. I mean, there's a sweetness to a lot of them. They taste different. Well, we, of course, used up our time talking about all these colorful and wonderful things to grow, all of which now, of course, I want to order. But Talana and Mario from Peace Seedlings, thank you so much for making time today, for coming in from the outdoors and talking about some of these things. And I'll give all the information about how people can find you and find the seeds with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. But I hope I'll talk to you again soon. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. It's been great.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners on the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.